pretty sure the volume is up and everything, so I don't think there'll be any problem here. Pause it for a moment. But anyway, Paul Rodel again. It is now the 25th of July, and I'm back in the office of Bob Lovin here in the Agriculture Department. Is the red light on?
Yeah.
Really came to return the IVS annual report 66-67, but as long as I was here, I had a few questions from our last interview, and Bob has agreed to sit down again for a short time anyway and go through a few things. Good morning.
Good morning.
He also treated to coffee, so that's great. As I said, I was listening to it was actually a longer amount of tape than I had thought, because we seemed rushed, but it was really fairly, well, it was at least an hour and a half, getting on towards maybe an hour and three quarters, which isn't really so bad at all.
Good, okay.
I mean, some people do go on for 3 hours, but most end up around two.
Well, I probably could too, but.
Yeah, I mean, we all sort of could, but, you know.
Once you get started, I mean,
yeah,
have a couple of drinks in the bar and somebody asked me what I didn't allow, so I.
Yeah, off you go. But here we are at 8:30 in the morning or whatever it is now, and, you know, having only drunk coffee, we're liable not to do that.
Right.
But actually, I just mentioned the man's name, Pop Buell. Did you actually know him?
No.
Never even met him?
No, he was, I think he was already an aide when I was.
He would have been an aide at that time, absolutely.
Well, I take that back. I think I did meet him, but it was in passing.
Yeah, okay.
Radio Association.
All right. Yeah. Well, because he was in aid at that time, I didn't think that you'd have any associations. But I was more interested in impressions of the man because, you know, when I first started looking seriously at IBS, rather than just having known a couple individuals, the only thing I could find was on Pop Buell, so it seemed. You know, so
yeah.
He's sort of like the person that you eventually have to deal with in some senses. You know?
Well, there was certainly a mystique there and a lot of, you know, myth worship.
Yes, a lot of myth
among
worship.
The volunteers.
Yeah.
But I think we were beginning, the organization was beginning to have its own corporate personality and move beyond popular when I was there.
Yeah.
And that's not meant to be a negative, that's just that's
no,
just
that's a reality. Growth. No, this is an evolution of organization. No, I've had, I don't know how your years overlap, but a fellow named Dr. Bill Taylor, he was a veterinarian. He was probably earlier then, who said that Pop Buell treated him pretty much like as if he was his son and took him under his wing. And, you know, and then off tape would talk about how he cursed a blue streak that, you know, would wither a sailor, you know, but, you know, you know. And Lou Wolf knew him and didn't like him at all.
Well, that's what I say. I, you know, not that this needs to be off tape, but I think that there was a lot of feeling that Pop served the political interest mm-hmm. of the Lao, though he was, you know, trying to protect the refugees and deal with the mountain people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this interest in IVS, not, I mean, the kind of the body of the IVSers,
mm-hmm.
to not be overtly political.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, even, yeah, people in agriculture or education, I think, would all agree upon that.
Yeah.
And,
it, you know, it's almost possible to best be neutral.
Mm.
And that was part of, like I said last time, was part of my strategy or, you know, urgency to do the things that I did, was
mm-hmm.
to try to
mm-hmm.
give that aura of neutrality without giving up the protection that we needed if we were going to be there.
And just the basic support.
That's right. That's part
so
of
that you can have
yeah.
to do the job as well. Protection, I think, of more of security. And,
that's right.
And diplomatic presence and, you know, all of what that implies.
One thing I didn't mention too is one that we had as much trouble, maybe more, with the French than we did with the Lao, with the Petit Lao.
With the French.
With the French, and that's the reason I talk about Susan Robbins. You know, is that was one of the ways that I was able to kind of understand some of the. Yeah, because we were supplanting them
But this is already, at least by the time of your assuming the responsibilities of chief of party for the agriculture CD, or RD, program. That's already 67. I mean, they lost in 54. Hadn't they got the point yet?
No, no. Well, they were hoping to come back, I guess, at the end, you know.
And these Americans would be beaten. Poof.
We don't want to get off and long. But since then, I've done a lot of work in Europe, in the 80s in particular. And I've done an awful lot of work in France, and I've got some very good French friends. And I have a totally different opinion of the French from working with them in the 80s and 90s than I did when I saw them in Laos in the 60s. Even in Kinkaq, where I was stationed, there was a French military outpost not too far.
Really?
And it was, there were some, a handful of legionnaires assigned there. And they were antagonistic. And as a matter of fact, the attaché, you know, how truthful this was or not, I imagine it was a total fabrication, said that they were a security leak for where we were in Kinkaq, for our protection, and the fact that he didn't trust them, that they would not protect us, but they might do some things that would threaten us in terms of the communist path to Laos in Kinkaq, where I was stationed there. And then in Vientiane, they were fairly hostile, the officials. I mean, I even had some contact with the Russians in Vientiane, who were, at best politically correct, or at worst politically correct, and at best actually friendly at times, in a business sense.
Yeah.
But not the French, because the thing was, and this is what Susan Robbins and her husband, who was an English, or wasn't English, he taught something at the say there in Vientiane, said, it was the fact that the Anglo culture was displacing the French culture in Laos, not just the country. So it's more than, it's more than politics. There were more people studying English and French. There were more students going overseas. There were more Americans digging wells and bringing in medicine and, American pigs and, and that was all anti-French.
They saw it as anti-French rather than as...
You can lose the government, but you're not supposed to lose the culture. But their culture was being supplanted, and that was almost a worse slap than losing the political military.
So when you were in Kinkaq, how could they have been a threat?
Well, I don't know. That's what the military attaché was saying, in the fact that he wasn't comfortable that they would pass on security, that they might know about the communist movement, and that they might give false information
and leave you exposed and vulnerable.
That's right.
And fail to do their job protecting.
Well, that wasn't their job. But
they're there as military and peacekeepers.
Right.
What are they supposed to do?
Right.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that they had hung on so long.
Well, they were there in Lycée, and I guess they did a few aid things, and then there was the military. There was a military presence all through. I guess they were like observers or something. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'm used to reading the diplomatic correspondence from the time when Lansdale and company were setting up, Negotensiem, and of course that's 54, 55. And there the French in Saigon were just terrible. I mean, they were just so manipulative and lying at every twist and turn. But the point of putting in Siem was to get rid of the French. So here it is 11, 12 years later, and they're still up in different parts of Laos.
Yeah. I don't know how many places. Well, again, remember that area, the Champasak, was Prince Bonin's kingdom.
That's
so
right.
There was political reason for them to be there if they were ever had any hope of maintaining any semblance of influence.
So they would be sure just to maintain some sort of presence there, if at all possible.
Okay. For whatever reason, whether they ever harbored any comeback, which I don't really think they did. Maybe they wanted to, but just to maintain a presence and hang on to what they could.
To stem that terrible Anglo tide.
That's right.
Like the little Dutch boy.
That's right, exactly. That's
okay. It. All right. Well, That's an interesting memory. You know, when making a specific study, you sometimes lose sight of the total context. So I do appreciate that aside.
I mean, I've forgotten now what question we were pursuing.
Well, I was just asking generally about Popule, and you were talking about the corporate thing, and you know,
and I got on to the fact that the French were as much a problem as anybody.
Sure, right, exactly. Because I've sometimes asked about who people socialized with, and you know, there are mentions of missionaries, you know, American missionaries. So.
Well, there was a missionary or mission in Kinkaq, but they were on home leave the whole time I was there.
Oh, long time. So
they could go on home leave, you know, extended home leave. Maybe they've been there for 10 years or something, and they go home for extended.
Oh, you know, okay.
Assignments type thing.
Yeah. Okay.
They were a, you know, a Southern Baptist type of. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a denomination. Beautiful house back there, and the local Christian church, you know, kept the house up. And it was closed up. They kept it.
Mm-hmm.
Maintenance. Little church was a white stucco, you know, New England looking little church there in the middle of the
middle of the house.
Yeah, in the middle of the house actually was, you know, the Lowell, the government wouldn't let it be in the village, right, so it was out of ways.
Uh-huh.
It was part of the persecution.
Yeah, or at least keeping it at a little bit at bay.
Arm's length.
That makes sense.
I think the guy did come back, and he was back about, his wife and family didn't, he was still to come. He was back about 2 or 3 months before I left, Kinkaq.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't meet him then.
But just so brief, it's not hardly part of the context of
the
experience.
But one thing I do
experience.
Remember, though, he was, but I don't remember, he was pretty good at his rural development work.
Oh, really?
It wasn't just the proselytizing.
Okay.
You know, in terms of, it was a lot of self-help type stuff.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't limited his rural development efforts just to his own Christian flock.
Yeah.
Of course, it was a technique to...
Yeah, it was the technique then to go beyond non-sectarian approach. To move on to a different question. You mentioned, you know, I don't know if you'd want to say, but you said that there was one volunteer that you had to at least remove from his assignment, whether removed from the country is another thing at all, who had been getting too close to things military and such, and who had actually been helpful in calling in airstrike sort of things. Is it fair to say who that was?
Sure, but both my long-term and short-term memory are...
Oh no, they're all going.
Well, let's see if I can find his name. I think he came, though, after this name was written. You know, you want to stop the tape on look, or does it make any difference?
Yeah, why not? I'll stop the tape. Okay, I've turned this back on again. So the search for the man's name is in vain, at least for the 66, 67 book.
I'll do a better search and get back to you.
Okay, all right. Just to follow up on something that we talked about last time, were you the one who recommended pullbacks from the forward areas, or was that already in progress before you?
That was already in progress.
Okay. When did that pullback begin, approximately?
Well, I don't think we had anybody. I guess there was a few, kind of hazy on this, there were a few maybe there, but we pretty well, I think, pulled them all back, or the process was underway. I think there was one or two, though, that didn't. Well, this guy that I'm talking about, that I don't remember.
Right.
And then another one. But that was an ongoing. I guess it hadn't, the decision right now, the decision hadn't been finalized because we were in negotiation with the embassy about a couple of places.
Is that part of the contract stuff that you were talking about?
No.
Okay, all right. Just the ongoing negotiations.
Yeah.
All right.
In terms of site assignments.
Yeah, and that extended into even your own chief of party?
Well, the end of it, because during most of my chief of party rule, I had the best possible time because, as I said, you know, there was...
That's right, there was that lull in the fight.
Yeah, and so there wasn't like one. So we were expanding quite a lot, not in terms of forward areas, but there was nothing going on, so we were pretty free to roam the country.
Yeah.
That must have really been after I left, most of it, because there was a couple of sites, let's look up the names that were, that we were talking about and contesting. I can't believe how much I've forgotten. Well, I think Nambach was in its way up there, and that might have been one of them. Maybe I look at my newsletters and so on.
Yeah, actually, that's
jog memories.
Yeah, that's one of the values of some of the newsletter stuff, and that's why I've been so interested in reading them.
Now that was already. I mean, that was that really happened after I left. I guess the finalized all
the
that
finalized
stuff.
Pullback from the forward areas.
Okay.
Even during your own time, though, education had already been introduced. Was I would think.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right.
Did either you yourself or you in the plural sense, you know, decide consciously to put a greater emphasis on education and to cut back on agriculture or not?
Well, that wasn't discussed when I was there.
Okay. Because later that would happen. Yeah, you were. I didn't expect you to say yes.
Yeah, I mean,
because you were growing and things were fairly peaceful, at least for most of your chief of party years.
Taiwan duck thing was a big new project.
Mm-hmm.
The forestry group was expanding and
trying
to in between the forest, the hardwoods. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, so there was a lot of small, you know, like the forest program took about 5 people.
Mm-hmm.
And highly technical, so that was we were expanding into small, highly technical operations. And so that type of expansion has in terms of a lot of volunteers, like, you know, the ag program or the education program.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's
public health is also something that we were moving into, village public health.
Was that under you or was that under some other office?
No, that was under
Okay.
And Susan Robbins, I was telling you about.
Susan Robbins. There. you're holding the book.
Yeah.
What kind of public health did they do?
Well, most of it is that there was a cadre of public health people in the Vietnamese government out in the provinces,
mm-hmm.
excuse me, Vietnamese Lao government. And they worked with them much like the ag advisors worked with the ag agents.
Okay.
And a lot of it was home sanitation.
Okay. Preventive
medicines. Did a lot of work with trying to get people to give up their native childbirth stuff, which was extremely detrimental to the birthing process.
Uh-huh.
A lot of smoke and a lot of moisture.
Because
they build these birthing houses and then once you labor, go into the birthing house. That was always smoke-filled. Immunizations, you know, particularly in the youth. But it was most of it, I think, was focused on, that we were doing, as I remember, was focused on the conversation here, on the home and the family.
Okay. So this was not a program like the Operation Brotherhood, which had doctors and nurses doing more advanced care.
Yeah, where there were OB hospitals, they worked, you know, in cooperation with them, but mm-hmm. the OB hospital maybe had mobile clinics that went out. But
OB hospital?
Operation Brotherhood.
Ah, okay.
That's what we called them.
I've always just said the full name. Okay.
Right. But they would maybe go out with a mobile clinic, and then maybe they did.
Yeah.
But they just treated whoever came in, whatever the problem
was. Yes, I know.
And they probably did some, you know, preventative stuff, but that wasn't their mission. Where
not usual.
Yeah, well, it probably took an individual who was interested in doing that as opposed to a Filipino medical.
Yeah. Actually, I interviewed one person who joined IVS Vietnam who had been an OB Laos, and she had been recruited as an agronomist nutritionist to talk about planting and food types and things like that as they began to see that they had to do more than simply treat people who were already sick.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, I don't know how extensive. She may have been the only one that they ever recruited to do that, but, you know, they were at least realizing things. Okay, so, but that's the role you filled.
Yeah, that's
or tried to, yeah.
Right.
So it wasn't like a malaria program, spraying, you know, things like that. Okay.
No, it was, it really focused on the home, you know, clean water.
Yeah.
Clean up sanitation and with the cooking mm-hmm. area, you know, or childbirth, child, well, I don't remember child rearing, but there was mm-hmm. childhood immunization.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, right. I guess we got into a big fight, big stink too, over birth control. I mean, it was a non, basically a non-issue among the Lao because it's not overpopulation, but
mm-hmm.
there was some, and I think we ended up just saying, well, we weren't going to do it. I think mainly because there was other priorities, but it was kind of a silly thing. But it was, you know, Aid had a pot of money for, you know, so we were supposed to spend some of this money because it was, you know, earmarked for birth control.
Yeah, so you did it.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things, you know, is that, you know, whoever did it, maybe it was well-intentioned, but it was ill-applied in Laos. I mean, there was no really reason for it there.
Yeah, there are other places in the world. There was one thing I had, it was toward our rush end, where there were knocks on the door and such
Mac.
Like
that. The guy's name was Mac.
What's that?
This volunteer.
Oh. Oh, first name or last name?
Well, that was his nickname.
Mac. Okay. Yeah. Alright. Wow, that just sort of popped in there. Your subconscious was working.
Running through the.
Yeah, through the file system and finally said, here it is.
Go ahead, I'm just looking up here.
Yeah, well, I'm just waiting for the next thing to pull out. Well, toward the end of our time when people were knocking on your door and you had the meeting to go to at 11, we were talking very, very quickly about two people, Ambassador Sullivan, who you did talk about a little bit, and there was also a Dr. Thomas, who you mentioned had come from academia, who is somewhat torn in his position because he was working in like counterinsurgency and.
Well, the rural development program, as far as the embassy hard types, I guess the ambassadors, Sullivan, and particularly Mendenhall and Aid and those people, that the rural development program that Dr. Thomas ran was counterinsurgency.
That's the way they perceive that.
Yeah,
okay, I was confused about it because there's the title and the reality. Here,
yeah, because if you capture an area, then you pacify it,
mm-hmm.
and it was counterinsurgency is the way that was defined, and so that was what rural development was. You build a school,
dig the wells,
give them infrastructure that they then like because they built it, and the philosophy was, and therefore they'll protect it,
mm-hmm.
you know,
okay.
and they won't let the communists, you know. Because it's now theirs, they struggle, they got it, and so on. And, you know, Dr. Thomas was more of the, I don't know whether he was chairman, but he was in the social department at Cornell.
Okay.
And so he was more one of, you know, building the capacity of the Lao, you know, to take care of themselves. And if that happened to be counterinsurgency, but if there were political reasons to go do rural development, that's where he did the political reasons in terms of Petelau and Yamis, and or it may be even politics. I don't know. Maybe I'm sure there was some of that. That was where I thought he had his real struggle, was doing the rural development stuff, capacity building versus the counterinsurgency stuff.
Okay, so community development. He wanted to do, to put it in my own words, just to see that I got it. He would have wanted to do community development as a means of community-generated projects that they had a hand in deciding upon, evolving, participating in, rather than simply digging X number of wells, building X number of Y number of schools a political purpose, you know, and therefore putting the dots on the map we've got this little Maginot line.
Yeah.
Now,
draw the line
of
down
villages.
Like you know, which in this was the communist and, you know, the, what I'm doing here for the purpose of the tape recorder is
Northwestern
part of the,
The white part of the map, and then the black dots would be
the good guys. But, you know, he would say, you know, if there's a need over here where there's no pacification going on, just go work there.
Even though that's the tip of the country that's well into Thailand and completely secure.
Yeah, and so, but he says there's a need there, people want to do it, but Abe would say, no, you got to go up here.
Way up towards Vietnam.
That's right, and that was the conflict for him.
Ah, okay. How did you get along with him?
Pretty well.
Yeah, I would expect that, I mean, and
there was the ag guy, who was his counterpart, ran the ag program.
Uh-huh.
He was a Japanese-American. I can't put his name right now. But he was very personable, extremely personable, but forceful. And you get into a session with him, and he would just spout statistics and facts and, you know, so.
Really?
And just, you know, kind of bowl you over, you know, kind of because he was so, you know, forceful and so supposedly knowledgeable.
Uh-huh.
And he did something one day that I was meeting with him, and I thought, that's not right. I know that's not right.
Uh-huh.
And he made this stuff up. It was just his personality. And when I realized finally what was going on, I just gave it back to him. And we became great buddies because, you know, he knew I blew his cover.
That he was just spouting the figures to look good, but
that's
he
right.
was just full of it.
That's right.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah.
Anyway, that's, I guess those are the two main people that I've worked with in terms of the aid.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Thomas.
Yeah. Okay, so, no, that's a rough position for him to be in. I could understand. You know, you at least by this time would have had that quote-unquote veto power.
Yeah.
You know, because of the new contract, and had already moved out of the aid compound, and
our time is right now.
It's going faster than I thought. But no, I wondered about Thomas, because that's really when we were literally trying to put things away while also speaking.
That's right.
You know, and I just wondered what he was like, and you know, your reaction to it.
Well, he was an academician, you know, and he retired, and he was, you know, in his probably 60s then.
Was his name Winfred?
Howard, I thought.
Okay, I know of another Dr. Thomas who was Winfred Thomas.
That doesn't sound like it. Howard just popped in my mind.
No, you're probably correct. All right.
I was saying, you know, as an academician, he just, you know, was more interested in study and managing things, you know.
Uh-huh. It's a difficult transition to make, to go from the abstract.
Not that you can't manage it.
Well, you can sometimes, but sometimes it's just simply not directly applicable. You know, you have to take two or three more steps. And, you know, because now your tape's back on, you're talking about personalities that you knew, and that kind of assessment.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that at least when I was chief of the party, is that there was, and it may be the case now, I just don't know.
Yeah.
But back then, I was very impressed with the caliber of the board members. They were really, you know, insightful, intelligent, capable men, not only for any women, that were tops of their field.
You were talking about one in particular.
Yeah, Dr. Kitagawa. You know.
Yeah. Any others come to mind?
Yeah, well, there's another. Bishop O'Rourke. He was Monsignor O'Rourke at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think he retired here recently as bishop in Peoria, Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Matter of fact, I used to run across him all day. He was very big in the Catholic Rural Life Conference, maybe even was a founder or something of it. I don't know, I'm quite sure it was.
Mm-hmm.
But that was another guy that I had great respect for. And that was.
Did he also come to Laos on a visit?
He was often, it usually was the chair that they would send out on the tour during their chairman. The guy with the chair then would tour all the Vietnam, Laos, you know, wherever it happened to be. And those were the two, Dr. Kitagawa and Bishop O'Rourke. Well, he was Monsignor O'Rourke at the time.
Yeah. Who you got to actually meet.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Well, during their visit.
Yeah, became friendly with, and, Dr. Kitagawa didn't because he died, but Bishop O'Rourke stayed in touch with him.
Oh, have you?
Ran across him from time to time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I had a big rural development conference in Racine, Wisconsin at the Wingspread. At the Frank Lloyd Wright house.
Yeah. good place to have a conference.
Yeah, about 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe longer, and he was one of the, Bishop O'Rourke was one of the people mm-hmm. involved in the conference.
Super. Yeah, okay. A kind of concluding question, we may have to go to the first few feet of the next tape, I don't know, or the other side of this, rather.
I hope not feet.
Huh?
I said, I hope not feet. I thought you said the first few feet of the next side.
Yeah.
Well, it's feet,
well,
inches.
Well, feet, feet, well, oh,
feet,
yeah.
Feet, I thought you said feet.
Oh, no, I distance. Did. Oh, yeah. First couple of feet. I mean, that doesn't take very long in this thing.
I was thinking that, sorry.
No, oh. Well, maybe only inches. Do you have any, what if someone would tell, you know, be asking about your Laos experience? I know that doesn't happen every day. Is there any favorite story that you tell?
Mm-hmm. Well, you just start out by saying, gosh, it's been so long ago that it seems like it's a book that I read rather than something I lived.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is so different, and some of the memories are so sharp and vivid,
mm-hmm.
and color, and I can almost see the color and smell the smells. Well, I think there was a going away Basi, that group that I built, they'll build that school that I said that I just did it because I thought they deserved it and would do well with it.
And this was that middle. I think it's gone.
We had quite a celebration, and it was one of real, there was a vast difference in terms of culture and all of that stuff, and it was like one that, you know, I really was leaving a family, and they were sending a family member off,
uh-huh.
and that was, I guess that was one. Another one was the two volunteers that were killed.
Oh, yes.
And those were very...
Chidler was one, right?
Yeah, and there was one down in Parkside, not in here, because that was before, I mean, that was after this came about. But...
And wasn't there a Lao that was killed along with Chidler? Like a co-worker?
I don't remember that.
I may have been confused with someone else then. Could be.
But that was tough.
Yeah.
Sitting down and writing a letter to the family, and I guess that maybe a criticism that, of Lao at the time, of the Ibis at the time, I didn't know what to do. I mean, you know, I was also one of the volunteers that had been killed. You know, what do you do? You know,
yeah.
How do you handle it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that, I guess that was one. But I guess overall, it's just the fun that I had with the Lao.
Yeah. It's in the other room, it's okay.
Whether, like I said, the minister or the vice minister who was Pete Lau or the ag agent in Kinkuk who I knew was probably Lau, or Pete Lau, having fun with them and connecting
mm-hmm.
with them and,
yeah.
and doing things. And,
well, it was the Chow Twain?
No,
was
the Chow
Quain.
Chuck Quain, yeah.
Yeah.
The, that's another one, but I'm talking
yeah.
about the, this is the ag agent. And,
mm-hmm.
and there was an old man who was the head of the ag service. It wasn't him, it was one of his agents. But anyway, it's just the ability to have fun, I mean, in a positive, constructive sense, as opposed to being, you know, tight and maneuvering like you often have to do in,
mm-hmm.
in this bureaucracy.
Yeah, no, yeah.
I don't know, I guess those are three. I mean, of course, it started my married life and our family, and also those are other memories, but that's not
yeah.
directly related to the job.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the satisfaction, too, of seeing things done, the Lao building a school and being proud of their school, building
yeah.
it well, and,
yeah.
You know, that type
and
of stuff.
And making use of it. especially if it was the Sweetwater that you got killed away from where it was supposed to be.
That's right. Yeah, and then, you know, there was always a bossy, you know, the Buddhist monks would be there and all that type of stuff. You know, that was always fun and rewarding. I really hadn't thought much about that, though.
About?
Your question, you know, is what strikes me most, because there's so much there. I remember standing at the top of the monument, the war monument there in Vientiane. I don't know if anybody ever told you about that. That's what they call it, the first airport. The airport in Aid gave Lao a bunch of money and cement to build, to reinvent, upgrade the airport in Vientiane. And somehow the money and cement disappeared, and all of a sudden they started building this
big monument.
This big monument, and it's like a foot taller than the Arc de Triomphe. It looks like the Arc de Triomphe, but with
no.
Lao, you know, the Buddhist, you know, adornments, as opposed to. Anyway, I was standing on top of that monument.
How do you get up there?
You just walk up. Maybe the one, just like the Arc de Triomphe, you know, one of the legs. There are stairs that go up.
Oh, there are stairs within. Yeah. Okay.
You know, and so it was one of the fun places to go and just kind of see the city, and it was quiet and so on. And there was this just ordinary old Lao man was sitting there, and struck up a conversation with him. I don't really know what the conversation was about. And, it was just a fun, another one of those fun things where we just sat and kind of talked, and, you know, and I'd ask him questions and answer him. He'd ask me questions about, you know, the stuff that I was doing.
Yeah. You mentioned one thing that we talked about, actually, last time, and I don't know if there's necessarily a need to revisit it, but the death of Scheidler and then the other fellow. And something occurred to me. Had you received any forewarnings or forebodings that they might have been in danger?
No.
Okay. So they themselves may not have been warned? Of course, you wouldn't necessarily know that.
Yeah. Both of those were passive.
We did mention that last time.
Yeah, that they just, you know, thought that their good works protected them, and they just got themselves out too far.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I just wondered if back in the capital you might have gotten some vibes coming in that they might have been too far out, but you hadn't.
You mean after the fact?
No, before the fact.
No, things didn't move that fast.
Yeah.
I mean, the communications weren't that fast. You were really, just like the story I told you about the spirit woman, you know.
That's right.
You know, you really had your early warning system was what you could develop on site.
Yeah.
The only thing that the embassy did was that if there was massive troop movements or some intelligence about a battle coming, of course, I was in the, and most of that's one of the reasons for forward areas, when you got them, we were not close enough for that type of stuff to happen. And so where the work was on a communication and pickup system, if something happened.
Okay.
So you really had to.
The individual out there
individual was on their own, more or less. But they had a walkie-talkie, and you had a signal, you'd call a plane, or, you know, and you had two or three drop or pickup sites that were helicopter, helicopter to get in that you were supposed to go to. You were supposed to have a black bag with dark clothing and food and water in it. You know, you were supposed to have that stuff, you know, all the time.
Really?
But that's about it. Yeah, that's about all the embassy ever did.
You mean it's kind of like your escape gear?
That's right. Oh, yeah, you had a. It was one of those awkward big old field radios, you know, walkie-talkies, and you see that, you know, nowadays they're ancient, antiques. But we all had one of those in that bag, and we had, they call MRIs now, they call, what they used to call the field meals?
Oh, the sea rations? Yes.
We had, two or three sea rations and a bottle of water and dark clothing and that one in a black, dark bag of some type, you know, that with straps on it.
So you could put it over your shoulder?
That's what you grab, but there's a problem.
You just grab the bag and
crawl out the window and go. That was what the instructions were. You know.
Wow.
I never had to do that, I won't say that.
Well, no, I don't suspect many people did.
That's right. And I don't know how many people actually took the black bag seriously.
Yeah, but I hadn't even heard about the black bag, which maybe indicates that not many people did take it too seriously.
Well, it was and where I was in Kinkuk, for the reasons I told you earlier, because Ho Chi Minh Trail and Prince Manu and so on, you know, we had fairly regular visits from a colonel. It wasn't always the same one. And the embassy, and that was something he was always, you know, making sure where our pickup zones were, and, you know, it's radio work, where is it, where's your black flag, you know, that that type of stuff.
Okay. It's probably on his checklist.
That's right.
So he had to do it.
Yeah, if anything happened, he did his piece.
That's right. No, yeah, he'd want to have his ass covered if there was something going on there. As of the final, how does, what did you do after, you know, not detail of the whole thing, but how has the IVS experience affected you in the long term?
I don't know if I, well, of course, I wouldn't have my family.
That's true. That would be a little more difficult.
Marriage and,
yeah.
There's the
yeah, I was looking at your photograph here.
The other thing is I think I'm probably more aware and sensitive of other people and other needs.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that was only IBS.
Okay. Yeah.
I think I
there could be.
My
yeah.
Family and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I told you about the coolie looking glass self concept.
That's exactly,
you know,
right. Yeah.
They use that as a ministry. Gives me an opportunity to deal with that. You know, it's an interesting thing to have on your Vita.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Walt Collard got me my scholarship at Iowa State when I went for my graduate program.
Is that so?
Any IVS chief of party, all you had to say was you were a chief of party IVS Laos, and that was automatic. Because there were a string of, myself and then Jim Melia, yeah.
Melia, yeah.
All went there, and so we all were kind of.
He's in Tennessee now.
Yeah,
and
the TVA.
Mark will be seeing him.
I'm not so sure that that I added to the academics, but Walt was straight A's and top of the class and the best
mm-hmm.
that he ever had.
And then he'd been sending back these other folks with field experience.
That's right.
A substantial field experience
right.
in international development.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. That'd be an automatic entry into my program, I'll tell you. people with that are golden. So what I hear you saying, if I could again repeat your words and see if I've got it right in my own understanding, is that the IVS experience built on and was then used as a block to continue building on a kind of natural progression.
I might not have ever really realized who and what I was.
Okay.
But
so personally,
yeah. You know, I guess also the. Naivete
mm-hmm.
to go do as opposed
yeah.
to not worry.
Yeah.
And things will take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, for many, we ask this because for many people, and for others, such as yourself, it's part of a progression that they
yeah.
that they fit within a greater context without and being important, but not necessarily revolutionary.
Yeah, there was.
And some people
major,
who just leave it, just like as if their
2 years
life was
back to
yeah, to whatever
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting to see. I mean,
well,
there are very few of those latter category.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I would have done with the political science degree without Laos. So it got me in a probably as we think as I think it probably got me in a career path.
Mm-hmm. A little more focused.
Yeah,
more credentials.
And then when I went to his master's program in. Complex organizations,
mm-hmm.
social change, based upon my Laos experience and
yeah.
to the work I do now. So, in that sense, it probably had a maybe it was on the same trajectory, but it really lit the fuse, probably.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Important, though not necessarily revolutionary.
Yeah.
Changing
it
you from a philosophy
yeah.
major to,
right.
you know, someone who now works in the Department of Agriculture.
In rural development, though.
Okay. But in rural development, but nonetheless within the Department of Agriculture rather than faculty of philosophy or something.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Bob, thank you very much again.
Well, Paul, it's been a pleasure to
and
read some of these.
Turn this
I've got your address,
off again.
And so I'll look for.